Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. This is FP Live. Welcome to the show. So, another escalation in the Middle East. In the early hours of Friday, Israel's military struck deep inside Iran. The strike was on a military airbase near Esfahan, a city in the country's center. Iran says it fended off a separate attack in Tabriz, about 500 miles north of Esfahan. All of this, unprecedented as it is, was a retaliation to Iran's unprecedented attack on Israel on April 13th, when Tehran launched hundreds of armed drones and cruise and ballistic missiles at Israel. That was the first ever direct military attack from Iranian soil on Israel. And with the help of the United States and some Arab and Gulf countries, Israel says it thwarted 99% of the projectiles. And all of that, of course, stay with me here, I want to get the chronology right here, was in response to a suspected Israeli strike on an Iranian diplomatic compound in Damascus earlier this month. Now, Iran and Israel have long been at war. They've had a shadow war of sorts against each other since 1979. But these latest strikes and counterstrikes and counterstrikes have crossed lines that existed before. The line that they wouldn't directly attack each other from each other's soil. The line that diplomatic missions were off limits, although that particular norm has been violated in the past as well. All of this, all of these norms and rules seem to have changed in the month of April. And it means we're entering an uncertain and unpredictable new phase of a complicated struggle in the Middle East. In the aftermath of the latest attack, the one Israel launched on Iran on Friday, it seems for now that both sides are trying to downplay what happened. Perhaps it's an acknowledgement that both sides want and need to de-escalate tensions. Both sides want to claim and spin victories for their domestic audiences. Take the win, as US President Joe Biden has been urging Israel, at least. But we don't know for sure whether either side is actually done. They could still continue to act out against each other. They could still try other arenas of attack, for example, cyber attacks. And of course, there's still an ongoing proxy war, which is dangerous, and that never really stopped, especially since October 7. An array of Iran-backed groups, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthi rebels in Yemen, among others, continue to exchange fire with Israel. And Israel continues to make inroads into Gaza as it chases down what's left of Hamas, also Iran-backed. And amid all of this, the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is getting worse and worse. Today's episode was meant to be gaming out how Israel might retaliate against Iran. Right after we taped, Israel retaliated. But I still want to bring you large chunks of the conversation we had, and that's because many of the ground realities haven't changed. What kinds of domestic pressures are both sides facing? Why are they acting the way they are? Where do they actually see things headed? And what can the United States do in any of this? I have two terrific guests. Suzanne Maloney is an Iran expert who's advised both Democratic and Republican administrations. She has written or edited three books on the country, the most recent of which is The Iranian Revolution at 40. She's the vice president and director of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. And Ronan Bergman is one of Israel's top investigative journalists. He's a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and the Israeli paper Yediot Aharonot. His most recent book is Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. As you know, we conduct most of these interviews live, hence FP Live, and every now and then live conversations come with their own complications. We had some technical difficulties on this one. We've tried to clean them up for you. But this is a good reminder. If you'd like to follow us live, which is exciting, and if you'd like me to take some of your questions, which I often do, head to our website, foreignpolicy.com. You can sign up there for a subscription with the discount code FPLive. That's FPLive, one word. Okay, that's it from me. Here are the experts, Suzanne and Ronan. Let's dive in. Welcome to FP Live. So, Suzanne, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the various domestic pressures that Iran is facing right now. They've had the hijab protest movement going on for well over 18 months. There are all kinds of economic concerns that Iranians have to deal with. They may have more sanctions now that could be imposed on them if there was anything left on the table, but by the West. And then you also have succession planning underway for Khamenei. Talk to us a little bit about how all of this plays into the decision-making in Tehran and where within all of that Israel and Gaza fits into their calculus.
I think that's a really important dimension to this issue that probably hasn't received enough attention over the course of the past week. Iran's revolution is aging, and it is nearing a very, I think, significant succession process. The supreme leader is in his mid to 80s. He has been in that position since 1989, and there is not a very well understood successor to him. There are various candidates for that position. None of them have a considerable amount of charisma or political skills. The current president, Ibrahim Raisi, who's credibly accused of crimes against humanity in some of his prior positions, who has demonstrated, I think, a fairly tone-deaf approach, even for the regime itself, to some of the challenges that the country is facing, is probably the best known amongst those contenders. The other very well-known, well-rumored individual who's often talked about is Mojtaba Khamenei, the son of the current supreme leader. And that would, of course, invoke the precedent of something that is more reminiscent of the monarchy that the Islamic Revolution displaced. And so I think probably not a likely outcome, but certainly Mojtaba is a key figure within the system. But this debate about precisely how and when succession comes, and more generally, how we see this kind of turnover of leadership within the system itself. Many of the original revolutionary generation are now in their 70s and 80s. They have begun to pass from the scene, but they've also begun to become excluded from political life, whether it's the former president, Hassan Rouhani, who was very much involved with the politics behind the 2015 nuclear deal, certainly other senior figures, some of whom have been under house arrest for 15 plus years because of their support for reform within Iran. This is a system that is beginning to pass to the hands of a younger generation, very much battle-hardened veterans of the Revolutionary Guard, of the Iran-Iraq War, and all of the skirmishes that Iran has been involved with since that time. And what we've seen is a real hardening of the system in the hands of these individuals. And I would say that, you know, what happened last weekend, in many respects, was the culmination of a leadership that has been more inclined to adventurism, to risk tolerance. We know, of course, they've targeted former officials from the Trump administration, many of whom are still under protective custody. They've targeted dissidents and others around the world, including some in the United States, in a very serious and dangerous fashion. They've also, of course, expanded and entrenched their role across the region and their willingness to use violence to try to advance their own interests and aims. And I think that that, you know, when I first studied in Iran and had an opportunity to understand the country, I think many of us 25 years ago anticipated a liberalization, at least in modest fashion, some kind of reform that might gradually make Iran more of a responsible player at home and on the international scene. That hasn't happened at all. And in fact, we've seen just the opposite.
And let me ask you about Netanyahu's standing amid all of this. I mean, the protest movement against him had really picked up again in the last month or so. last weekend's attack seems to have rallied everyone, Israeli society, around Netanyahu once again. What kinds of main domestic pressures is he facing, Ronan?
I'm not sure I agree that the Iranian strike has increased the support to Netanyahu. It's all seen by much of the Israeli public as just another failure of Netanyahu, just another disaster. It's, in a way, aligning some of the public behind the military or the defense establishment, though the trust in those after what happened on October 7 is also very, very low. I think that it takes, the only advantage Netanyahu can see there is that it takes some of the attention from the hostages issue, which he's struggling between the pressure of the families and the public, which has a clear majority for a deal, even in the price of a final and total ceasefire, and the coalition, where the ultra-right parties of his coalition are saying, if you surrender to Hamas demands, we will disassemble the coalition. And just to quote one of my colleagues, veteran journalist in Israel, Nahum Barnea, the chief columnist for Yediot Ahronot, the Israeli biggest daily, he said, all politicians have themselves at the center and all the rest in the background. For Netanyahu, he said, there's no background.
Suzanne, how do you think Iran is thinking about all of these proxy groups that it's funding in the region, the so-called axis of resistance?
Well, it, you know, for a regime whose primary goal is simply to stay in power, that is a very dangerous and unpredictable moment for them. They've survived an awful lot over the course of the past 45 years, you know, internal terrorism, external invasion, earthquakes, drought, pandemic. In terms of what it means for the proxies, you know, Hezbollah is the most valuable asset that Iran has. Obviously, the Israelis have been hitting back at Hezbollah, I believe, including today, throughout the course of the Gaza war, and obviously before then as well. Hezbollah is a significant concern to the Israelis because of its significant, you know, massive arsenal of missiles, very advanced and precision guided missiles. And so I think that that's the jewel in the crown for the Iranians. And that will be critical to their ability to coordinate and deploy as effectively as they've been doing some of these other militias. So I think that's the other, you know, the other big concern for Iran and its future strategy is what happens to Hezbollah.
And you are listening to Foreign Policy Live. Remember, you can watch these conversations live and on video on our website, foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to send us questions in advance, in addition to a range of other benefits, including our magazine. Sign up, use the code FPLIVE for a discount. That's FPLIVE, one word.
Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Ronan, I just want to zoom out a little bit here. You know, it was striking to me that the United States shot down more Iranian drones and missiles than Israel itself. And that's despite the fact that the sort of so-called ironclad alliance that the U.S. has been talking about, it has in fact been shaken and strained in recent months. And then you add to that the fact that Arab and Gulf countries also came to Israel's assistance, notably Jordan, which has been increasingly critical of Israel's actions in Gaza. Talk to us a little bit about how that's been playing out in Israel. Does that mean that any of these countries have more leverage to push Israel to change its strategy at all?
I think that the last few months have shown us that the Netanyahu regime has this organ of gratitude does not exist for it. They are continuing, and the prime minister is continuing in the same policy that basically cherished the integrity of the coalition and putting everything else, even at the same time when the IDF is much dependent on the continuous flow of munition and Iron Dome interceptors, etc. But at the same, when the US, the President Biden stood so firm at the side of Israel after October 7th, and is taking so much risk of his political career because of Israel, because of losing support from some of his base, and the government, the prime minister, feeling that this will serve them in the popularity, in the keeping the coalition together, they have no problem with going into public fights with the US president, which doesn't make any sense if you look at this, unless you understand that the integrity of the coalition, the continuation of the war on a low intensity level, and making everything possible to not going into the stage of people going to the streets to demand inquiry, to demand an investigation, and to demand new elections. And so this is the only thing. This is the only thing that it dominates why Israel did not yet sign the hostage deal. It explains why Israel is still claiming to be fighting a war in Gaza, where there is no military in Gaza, only the one basically tearing the, slicing the strip into two parts, but all the military is out. Claiming that there's war when there's no war, claiming that they're still fighting Hamas, but they're not. And this explains everything. I think, however, that because of feeling, this goes back to your question, because of feeling such gratitude to the Americans, the defense establishment is now very, very keen on not doing anything that will not be fully coordinated, or at least not totally objected by the US. And it seems to me from multiple sources that the US has said, we will not support you if you go for a strike. But if the strike is containable, if there's a chance that Iran would not react, then we will continue to defend you in case it does. We are talking about two enemies that don't want to go to all-out war. But we also see Israel vis-a-vis Hezbollah throughout the last 6 months, not wanting to go to war, but making sure that they are not risking that. And what they do is very limited. What Iran has done is taking an enormous risk. And I know that a lot of people in Israeli intelligence are now looking at Iran, thinking, what is the mindset, the new mindset of the supreme leader? Why did he order, with all due respect to his relations with the late Mahdavi, and the need to make a point and to revenge and to go following some demands from the Revolutionary Guard, but why the supreme leader took such a risk? My guess, this is mostly speculative, he saw Israel in its weakness time. It's the same like Sinwar making the call back in October to strike Israel because he saw weakness. And I think that the supreme leader saw the immense international pressure Israel is under, that the operation in Gaza is going nowhere, rift between Netanyahu and Biden, and he said, that's our historical time to do something like that and make a point and put the flag on the top of the city.
Suzanne, I want to bring you in on that just to react. If what Ronan is describing is accurate, that Iran spotted a moment of immense Israeli weakness and acted on that, how does that then play out over the next 6 months? Assuming that, you know, Israel's status quo will not improve much from where it is right now, does that mean that will guide Tehran's reactions and its use of proxies in a similar way to react and take advantage of a moment of weakness?
Well, I think that the explanation that Ronan has just offered is one that's completely consistent with the way that Iran has approached the war and even, you know, the lead up to the war. So the Supreme Leader gave a speech, I think it was October 3rd or 4th, in which he, you know, used the very traditional rhetoric about Israel passing from the page of time or whatever the proper translation of the Persian expression is. But what you see from that speech, in which he predicts that Israel will die of rage, and everything that he said, and he talks about Israel on a very regular basis in his sermons and in his other public speeches and remarks, that it is this presumption that and it's very consistent with the way that Iran has approached the question of Israel since the revolution itself, that Iranians, frankly, were the Islamic Republic was not particularly interested in ever going to war with Israel for a variety of reasons, including the expectation that it might not win. But also the presumption has always been that Israel was going to just simply collapse or erode. And I think that they, and I'm sure, as Ronan said, Sinwar, interpreted the intense debates within Israeli society and Israeli politics over the course of the past year or so as a huge opportunity, that the country itself was divided, the same way that they looked at the Trump period in the United States as evidence of polarization, weakening, corrosion of society and politics. And yes, I believe that this is part of why we're seeing more assertive action from the Iranians. They think that there's an opportunity here. They want to make the most of it. And so their best levers to do so, for the most part, have always been the various proxies, to try to apply as much pressure as possible and to try to ensure that Israel shrinks within its own borders, that it is delegitimized around the world, and that the political divisions within Israel, as well as the economic cost of the conflict, contribute to this long-term process of the failing of the Israeli enterprise. That's what they believe about Israel. It's what they believe about the United States, for that matter.
We're almost out of time. Ronan, I'm going to close with you. I wanted to talk just a little bit about Gaza, which, of course, you know, if you look at October 7 as the start of this phase of the war, what happens next there, given everything you're saying about Israel's moment of weakness, given everything you've described about Netanyahu's incentives and how he's thinking about what's ahead of him? What happens next in Gaza?
I think that there are basically two options. And I know it's very risky to say something like that about the Middle East, especially this time. I told a colleague from the US asked me to explain the last year and a half in Israel. And I said, if we would go into the New York Times time machine, we have such equipment, and we go back in time to early 23, and we go to 100 Israelis, and we tell them we are from the near future, and now we will tell you what will happen in the next 15 months. We will have 100 Israelis, no exception, that would set us to be falsely hospitalized, because they will say, now you just gave us the proof that you are not from the future, because what you describe cannot happen, will not happen. All the events, and by the way, if Netanyahu would be that selection group, he will do the same. He didn't see at least much of that evolving. And didn't want this to evolve. He even didn't want to go into, I know this maybe changing the mindset about Netanyahu. He's not a trigger happy person, because he knows that once you go to a military campaign, you don't know how this will end. He tried to disrupt and sabotage the Israeli preparation for going into Gaza. I was told he was sort of even disappointed when President Biden said to him, we will understand if you invade Gaza, back in October. Now, of course, that took its own dynamic.
And when you say he sabotaged that attempt, that's to prolong it, basically.
Oh, not to start it. He didn't want to start that, because in Netanyahu's mind, and again, it's his mind, he had nothing to do with the October 7 failure. It's not him. It's the military, and we also see from the propaganda machine that he activates it, and the people working for him in the media and Channel 14, which is like the Israeli Fox News, or that they say it's all about the military. The military failed, and they did not report to the prime minister. And of course, it's ludicrous because the prime minister is in charge of everything.
Right.
By Axios features, by his job, he is the head, and therefore he is responsible for what happened. But he also knew that even if he sees himself as not guilty for October 7, once he gives the military the order to advance, this will be on his, in any case, this will be on his responsibility. And he tried to prevent it. But of course, with the media and the public pressure, it got its own wings. I think that now it's either Israel is forced in few months to evacuate. And again, Israel is not fighting a war, but a very limited military incursion in Gaza since mid-early January. This is not to say anything about the unbelievable suffering of the refugees and the hunger and the people dying. But the idea of stop fighting, which is by itself a vote of disconfidence in the targets and the ability to achieve the targets of the war. So it's either Israel forced by the US and the international community and the internal pressure that stopped believing in this war to withdraw, or Israel agrees to what Netanyahu is trying to prevent all the time, which is a discussion to the so-called day after, how the Palestinian Authority is introduced to take control with the help of the Gulf states and some kind of reform, of course, the US, and do that as a part of a full hostage versus Palestinian inmates deal that will also give Hamas many releases of very famous inmates and a total ceasefire. This will be, of course, much preferable. It will enable Israel to reap the fruits of some of the fruits of the limited success of the military campaign. I think that Netanyahu will do everything he can to stop it, not to enable it, because this will mean the end of his coalition. This is what he's trying to do, to maintain some kind of leverage to Hamas, not to allow the Palestinian Authority, because then he will be forced to discuss two-state solution and losing his base. And again, we go back to his coalition.
And that was Iran expert Suzanne Maloney and the Israeli journalist Ronan Bergman. If you want to follow who we have coming up next, just go to our website, foreignpolicy.com/live. FP Live, the podcast, is produced by Rosie Julin, and the executive producer of FP Live is Dana Shern. I'm Ravi Agrawal. I'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Annalise Riles, professor of law at Northwestern University. I'm also an anthropologist and the host of a new podcast, Everyday Ambassador, where we give you the small tools that make big change. The idea for this show has been a long time in the making. I actually remember the exact day I started thinking about it. It was March 11th, 2011. I was in Japan conducting research on the financial markets of Tokyo. All of a sudden, I heard a loud rumbling sound and the room started shaking. Everything came crashing off the shelves. I looked out the window and I could see the skyscrapers swaying so much that they looked like they would touch. And then the sirens started going off. A tsunami was on the way. These were the harbingers of one of Japan's worst ever disasters, the meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant.
The Japanese government now says two reactors are in partial meltdown and four more are at risk.
The meltdown completely turned Japan on its head. I saw hundreds of stunned office workers covered in dust walking down empty train tracks to get from the city to their homes in the suburbs. Electricity was out, internet, cell phones. Supplies flew off the shelves of stores. Geiger counters became an in-demand item, which is never a good thing. Living through a crisis of this magnitude was an inflection point for me. To prevent the next Fukushima or any of the other crises we face today, we'll have to work much more effectively across silos of expertise and national boundaries. And we'll need to harness the wisdom of everyone, from local fishers to nuclear physicists, on how the world really works and what happens when things go awry. Using this approach, I've gone on to spur countless innovations in global policy. And that's what this podcast is all about. Everyday Ambassador peels back the curtains of high-stakes leadership and gives everyone backstage access to the most powerful methods of diplomacy. In each episode, we'll break things down into deceptively simple moves that everyone can make to help build a more peaceful and sustainable world. Like giving a gift.
You want to make it tasteful. You want to make it thoughtful. You thought about the other individual. You thought about what their likes and dislikes are.
Or creating a fiction.
Taking on a fictional scenario and a role outside of the one that you occupy in your day-to-day life allows you to think through what you would like to have done differently.
Or just taking the time to have fun.
Trying to see this as more so building long-term relationships that are going to be helpful down the line when negotiations are a bit harder, as all negotiations are.
Each week, you'll hear surprising stories which reveal the moves you can make to change the status quo, to find ways to connect and move things forward. So join me and become an Everyday Ambassador, coming to you this spring on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.